Earlier this week on Fresh Air, book critic John Leonard called Cynthia Ozick's new novel, The Shawl, a dazzling work of art. He described Ozick as a writer who demands moral purpose of literature. In her new book, he says, she bears witness to the death of poetry and the death of reason everywhere. Today, Ozick talks with us about her work. The Shawl follows a theme she has explored before in her fiction, what it means to be Jewish. The Shawl is divided into two parts. The first takes place in a concentration camp. Rosa Lublin watches in horror as a Nazi guard murders her infant by throwing her against the electrified barbed wire fence. Part two is set decades later in America. Rosa is an old woman gone mad, living alone in a shabby hotel for the elderly in Florida, still obsessed by the murder of her baby. Cynthia Ozick writes novels, short stories, and literary criticism. Her fiction includes The Pagan Rabbi and Leviathan. The Shawl combines two short stories she wrote in 1977 and originally published separately several years later. She told the New York Times that it took her a while to publish these stories because she was reluctant to make art out of the Holocaust. I asked her to elaborate.
Well, it seems to me that this is an event that we have hardly assimilated yet. There is a torrent of documents. They're endless. They keep coming. New revelations, it seems that we will never have an end of them. And it strikes me that this is something that fiction should not be applied to. This subject requires of us to learn it as it happened. And we should not make myth of it, or poetry, or little story. And obviously, I've completely gone against my convictions here and have written fiction, and not only in this book, but again and again in short stories and in other novels. And I've done that almost helplessly, almost against my will. It seems to me that what we need to do, what we ought to do, is absorb the documentation so that we know what really happened.
Cynthia Ozick, I'm going to ask you to read a passage from The Shawl, and it's divided into two separate stories. One takes place during the Holocaust, and in which Rose's baby is murdered by a Nazi guard. This is the beginning of the section right after, decades later, when she's moved to Miami.
Rosa Lublin, a mad woman and a scavenger, gave up her store. She smashed it up herself and moved to Miami. It was a mad thing to do. In Florida, she became a dependent. Her niece in New York sent her money, and she lived among the elderly in a dark hole, a single room in a, quote, hotel. There was an ancient dresser-top refrigerator and a one-burner stove. Over in a corner, a round oak table brooded on its heavy pedestal, but it was only for drinking tea. Her meals she had elsewhere, in bed or standing at the sink, sometimes toast with a bit of sour cream and half a sardine, or a small can of peas heated in a Pyrex mug. Instead of maid service, there was a dumbwaiter on a shrieking pulley. On Tuesdays and Fridays, it swallowed her meager bags of garbage. Squads of dying flies blackened the rope. The sheets on her bed were just as black. It was a five-block walk to the laundromat. The streets were a furnace, the sun an executioner. Every day, without fail, it blazed and blazed, so she stayed in her room and ate two bites of a hard-boiled egg in bed with a writing board on her knees she had lately taken to composing letters.
This is a person whose life has not improved in a way after the Holocaust. I mean, she's still living without a life. What gave you the idea for this woman who, decades after the Holocaust, spends her last years in a flop house in Miami?
Flop house. I hadn't quite thought of it like that, but in a sense it is. A flop house for elderly, retired, lost souls, none of them quite so lost as Rosa. What gave me the idea, it's a curious thing, I once went down to Miami to do a lecture, and I stayed overnight. I stayed in a very fancy hotel. That fancy hotel also makes an appearance in this story. And I got off the plane, felt the steaminess coming up from the ground, was driven along Collins Avenue just very briefly in a car with a driver, and saw Miami for, oh, I don't know, 5 minutes. Miami at night the next morning, delivered my lecture and was away on the plane and left Miami. And it was really based on perhaps those 10 minutes of a night drive along the main drag of central Miami. And that's where I saw that town in that nightmarish way. And why I put her there, I don't know. It seemed to be the place she would go. She's broken up her store. She's about to be arrested in New York. She's half crazy. Her niece ships her off. And where is she going to ship her off? To the place where the old people go, which is Miami. So that's how it came about. But you know, there's that famous Tolstoyan statement, anybody can write about a battle who's seen a street fight. So in a sense, the nightmarish quality of Miami came to me through just a glimpse from a car window.
Can you describe a little bit what you saw in that glimpse from the car window?
Black night, flashing neon, a sense of deep honky-tonk, and everyone on the streets, aged, elderly, warehoused in a sense, perhaps self-warehoused, lost, wandering. Now, this may be a most tremendous misrepresentation of the spirit of Miami and its retirees, but this is what I saw that one night.
Mm-hmm. When you were young, did you study Jewish culture at all, or is that something that became more of interest to you when you were older?
Well, I had an intensely committed home background. I went to Hebrew school after regular school. But essentially, I would say that after graduate school, I began a program of reading. I was reading, well, almost for years, 18 hours a day. At that time, I was catching up on all the novels I hadn't read. I was reading criticism, philosophy, history, and then I began to read a good deal of Jewish history. And it was, I would say, in my 20s that I really received my general education as well as my Jewish education, and both of them received, I think, more or less as an autodidact.
Sitting at home reading.
Yes, right. And you know about the education of the autodidact. It usually has a fool for a teacher. So it's an incomplete education and full of gaps of all kinds. But yes, I have been very interested in history in general and Jewish history in particular.
You've said that no matter what age you've been, you've suffered from youth envy.
Oh.
Could you describe what you mean?
Well, I suppose the truth is that inside this hoary head is an unreconstructed, arrested 22-year-old. And when I see photographs of myself today, there's this first moment of being completely astonished, startled, knocked out. Oh, this can't be me. You must be kidding. And I think probably for each one of us, there is a, quote, normal age. My theory is that we can find that age in our dreams. What age are you mainly when you dream? How old are you in most of your dreams? And that, it seems to me, is your true psychological age. And I think to myself that I'm very much arrested in earliness and therefore mortality and its fragilities come to me with enormous shock.
You know, you say that you feel like you were somehow arrested at the age of 22, or that you really think of yourself somehow psychologically as being 22, yet You've said that you feel like you were deprived of your youth because of all this time you spent reading and writing. And, I mean, you've even said that listening to Henry James cost you your youth.
Well, I think I spent my youth in old age. Perhaps that's what's behind this. I was, as most young writers are, wildly ambitious, consumed by it. Literature was everything to me. There was nothing else. Ideas at that time were secondary. Today it seems to me that ideas are emotions and emotions are ideas, and they're quite fused. But in those early years of reading and intense writing, there was I simply failed to live. I didn't do what young writers today do. They scramble around whatever city they find themselves in. They write reviews. They write short essays. They found magazines. None of this seemed possible in the early 50s. There was a very solid establishment. It had to be stormed. It couldn't be stormed. And in general, it was very, very difficult for me to get published. My first novel was not published until I was 36 years old.
Mm-hmm. What do you regret missing, anything, from that period when you were reading and writing and spending a life with books as opposed to a life in the world?
Well, I regret publishing. I regret not publishing. I was writing an enormous book at that time. The title was quite wonderful. It's from Blake, Mercy, Pity, Peace, and Love. I never finished it. I have 300,000 words of it stashed away someplace, and I wouldn't dare look at it. When I last looked at it, it seemed to me quite juvenile, although it was very ambitious. It was to be a philosophical novel. But I wish I had been less ambitious, not put all my eggs in that huge basket of that first endless, hugely conceived and unfinishable because too much novel. I wish I had been more modest, written reviews, written short stories, and begun to publish in a modest way, instead of believing, as I surely did, that one could be the elderly Henry James all in one gulp at the age of 22, and this is simply not possible. And this was my fantastic error. I mean, fantastic in its real sense. It was a fantasy. One has to be modest. One has to grow gradually. And I think young writers today don't do what I did. At least I don't see them doing this.
Well, you've said that as a young woman, you had contempt for ordinary life. What was the kind of ordinary life that you hated and didn't
young
want?
Young mothers with their children at their feet in sandboxes, maternity, normality, people who went to ordinary jobs. I was intensely devoted to the altar of literature. I burnt incense, so to speak, before it. Nothing mattered to me but books, writing, and the great geniuses of the English and American literary tradition, and the European literary tradition as well.
As a woman, was there family pressure on you to do the things, the family things that were expected of you?
Oh, yes. Yes. That, of course, aroused more contempt on my part. Then I discovered, at the age of 37, when my daughter was born, that in some way the normal world, the ordinary world, had been right all along. I used to say, oh, there is no philosophical reason to have a child. And the fact is, that's the only reason.
Explain.
Well, I think when a child is very young, one watches, one never finds it, but one watches for the beginning of language. The cognition is inborn, one can see that. Language is inborn, one can see that. But when one waits for the moment when there'll be that magical leap, that spark from babble to coherence, and coherence is always there before one has noticed. And there are the fascination of watching a human being come into existence and come into the legacy of humanity little by little, the joy of reading to a child, the joy of listening to a child, the joy of being a parent is a philosophical joy and not simply a biological joy. And I think when I worshipped at the altar of literature, I was quite foolish and quite childish in not recognizing that.
So you think it was a good thing to have a baby drag you in into the real world for a while, into ordinary life?
I would recommend it to every writer.
How old were you when you got married?
24.
And were you afraid that marriage would prevent you from having the life of the mind that you wanted?
No, it was quite enabling. Feminists have frowned at me for saying that some people were on a Guggenheim. I was on a Hallett. Hallett is my husband's name, Bernard Hallett. And I have been assaulted by my fellow feminists for being a parasite on my husband. But my reply to that seems to me very pragmatic in a writerly way, which is that a writer needs time and space to write and ought to get it from whatever source is gettable. If it's a foundation, fine. If it's a husband, fine. I think writers ought to scramble for time. And that's what writers need. They need large blocks of time and silence and meditation and reading and priming the pump and mooning around and musing. And this costs money. And I think writers are, by definition, parasites.
What has your husband done to make a living?
He's a lawyer.
Mm-hmm. Cynthia Ozick is my guest, and she's an essayist and novelist. You've said about Virginia Woolf, the life she lived and the people she knew didn't become real until she wrote about them. I was wondering if that was true of you also.
Well, I was referring to her diary keeping, and I think this, I've kept a diary since 1953. I agree with Kafka and what he said about conversation. It seems to me that conversation is air. Unless it's recorded, unless it's written down, unless it's kept, everything goes away unless we preserve it. And what writing is the preservation of our lives.
We talk about everything going away unless we preserve it. I don't know if you've ever experienced this, but I know you've read so much during your life. Do you ever fear of what you've read going away? In other words, that you'll forget it, that you'll, you know, that you're spending all this time reading, and how much of it can you really recall? Has that ever bothered you?
Well, it doesn't bother me because it suggests the joy of rereading.
Exactly. Yes. It's the only way I can find to reconcile forgetfulness.
Well, also, I think after a time, one stops reading new work. And one then devotes oneself to rereading. A real reader is a rereader in any case. It seems to me that I read a lot, perforce, a lot of new novels. Rarely do I find any 20 of them worthy of, let's say, The Death of Ivan Ilyich, Tolstoy's great story, or The Secret Sharer. Not that I'm turning to the 19th century exclusively. These are just quick examples that come to mind. The reason I am going to the 19th century now is to point out the value of rereading and the value of having literature, in a sense, marinate for several generations, so that one knows that one knows that what lasts is worthy because it's been tested and tested by the generations before us. Yeah. This is, of course, quite trite. I mean, I suppose I'm just speaking about the testing of posterity. Not that some literature isn't overlooked and lost, and our great paradigm of that, of course, is Melville.
Have your working and reading patterns changed at all as you've gotten older? Do you find that you spend any more or less time with a book or with the blank page? Do you get out more than you used to, is, I guess, the simple way of putting it.
I did get out more than I used to, and at a certain point in my life when I was doing a lot of public reading and a lot of public speaking, but I've withdrawn since and I think returned to my early recluse status of staying home and reading and writing. And I'm most comfortable with that kind of quietness and anonymity. And as far as writing goes, I'm just as slow as I ever was and scratch away at a sentence. Sometimes I'll spend an hour brooding over the position of a comma. Then, of course, some copy editor comes along and in one half second either puts the comma in that I had decided to remove or vice versa. But I do very much care about sentences and words and passionately about punctuation, which seems to me to be the cantillation of the sentence.
Okay. Well, Cynthia Osaka, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.